I had a plan for today's evening's talk, but we don't always control things so well. So I'm not sure how this is going to unfold now. As I sat here and as I went through the afternoon, kind of my plan kind of evaporated. What I wanted to do was talk about walking meditation, but we'll see. Maybe I'll get to it. When I went to, I visited India for just a couple of weeks, but I visited for a few days I stayed with a Vipassana teacher in Calcutta, a meditation teacher there. And while I was roaming around Calcutta, I had all my traveler's checks stolen. So I came back to the place I was staying, the temple I was staying with, and I told the meditation teacher that my travel checks had been stolen. And he said, it's important to be simple, but don't be a simpleton. So that was, you know, nice advice. So it's important to be simple, but not to do that naively. And I think that one of the hallmarks and one of the important of this kind of meditation practice we do is simplicity, being simple. And that a lot of the depth of transformative power that exists in this mindfulness practice comes from understanding something about simplicity, the nature of simplicity and how simplicity works in our life. And so I want to talk a little bit about that. First thing to say is that simplicity in the relationship to this practice has really to do with the way our mind works, our mode of perception, how we see the world. It doesn't necessarily mean we actually have to simplify our things in our life, which is nice for some of us to hear because we live in a very affluent part of the world. So it's not, so we think, oh, good, I don't have to give anything up. So that's for you to decide. But what I'm pointing towards is some kind of inner simplicity. And one of the early things we discover by doing a mindfulness practice is the degree to which we don't leave things be. We complicate our perceptions of things. We complicate it by judgments and projections. We have ideas and concepts of how things should be, how I should be, we should be, how the other person should be, how my spouse should be, how my boss should be, how this or that should be. Or we have judgments, or we have fears or anxieties. You know, anxieties have a lot to do about we're afraid that something's going to happen. Anxieties seldom have to do about what's happening to you, because there's no need to be anxious if someone's, if someone's beating you up, you don't have to be anxious about if they're going to beat you up or not. It's happening. And you have a whole other series of feelings and emotions, but not anxiety, because it's maybe a silly example, but the point I'm trying to make is that anxiety has mostly to do about what's about to happen, what's going to happen, not about what's happening. And as soon as we enter the world of what's going to happen, we have to enter, to some degree, into the world of conjecture, into ideas, into interpretations, projections, judgments, because we don't really know how it's going to unfold. One of the little pieces of homemade wisdom that I learned out from experience is that was not to worry so much about the future, because after many years of being worried about the future in various forms that it takes, the next meeting, the next day, meeting this person, getting some project done, or whatever, I noticed after many, many years of watching my life how often things didn't unfold the ways I was expecting them to unfold. And so all the worry I had about how things were going to be tomorrow were wasted energy, because tomorrow didn't happen the way my fears said it was going to happen. The meeting was canceled that I was worried about, or you know, a whole infinite number of varieties of ways which turned out to be different than my fantasy or my idea of what was supposed to happen. So I was a slow study, but finally I kind of learned, oh, maybe it's not going to be what I expect. And since it might not be what I expect, why don't I not worry about it so much? And a whole level of ease has come into my life because of not being so anxious about how things might turn out. I'll deal with things when they come. So there's many ways in which we complicate our perceptions of the world. And these complications are ways in which we add stress to our life, that we get stress. Stress is only a product of what our mind does, only a product of how our mind relates to, not only, stress is 99%, I would say, or 95% has to do with how our mind relates to what our conditions are happening to us. If we're in a stressful situation at work, we say a stressful situation at work. What we're saying is that the situation at work where there's a deadline and everybody's working hard and we have to get done by a certain time and we better hurry and work hard. The stress doesn't come from working hard or working overtime. The stress comes from contracting around it, the anxiety coming into play. We have a relationship of fear to that. We have a relationship of clinging, of grasping on things. We tighten up, we hunch up, we do all kinds of things in relationship to what has to happen. That the stress has to do with what we do to ourselves and situation, not the situation itself. It's possible to be very, very busy and very engaged and work overtime and be quite relaxed also. Stress has a lot to do with judgments. People experience that in meditation. If you have the judgment, the idea that a meditation hall is supposed to be completely silent. Yeah, I've heard simplicity is the way, right? So we want it really simple and no sounds. And then they have this noisy door. And so then you get really angry and it's really irritating, this noisy door that opens and closes. And what that, the sound of the door is meeting our judgment about how it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be silent. And then we set up resistance or anger arises or frustration arises because it doesn't meet our expectation. And then we start getting stressed because of that anger or resistance. It's not stressful to have the door open and closed many times. It's stressful to have all the resistance in relationship to it. So simplicity in the context of the door opening and closing is simply to be sitting here present and open and aware and hear door open and closing and not to add any judgments of what should or shouldn't be. This is what's happening and I just let it be as it is. Not to make judgments, this means that I was expecting to come here Thursday night this week and get enlightened. This was my week. I knew it was my lucky week. And then lo and behold, you come here and you're about on the brink of enlightenment, you're sure of it. And the door opens and closes. And suddenly the door has all this meaning. It's keeping me from... So all this represents a very busy mind. Attitudes and ideas that come into play, assigning a meaning onto things. And the opportunity exists is to discover a simplicity of being with things as they are, where we don't add what's said sometimes, a head on top of our head. Have you ever had a head on top of your head all the time? Thank you. You said it better than I could have. So the constant commentary and judgments and there's a little voice leading you around and telling you what you should do and trying to control things and saying, you're not good enough or you need to do better. A head on top of the head. It's like having two cooks in the kitchen. So what we want is, what we're looking for is simplicity. Where we allow ourselves to be as we are. Be really simple about our experience. And this is why in the spirituality of Buddhism, the spirituality of Vipassana, there's a tremendous emphasis on the ordinary, on ordinary life. They sit here and meditate, and we meditate on something phenomenally ordinary that goes on all the time. We meditate on the breath. It's about one of the most ordinary, mundane things going on. And we're sitting. Sitting for people, maybe in other ages, in other cultures, people don't sit as much as we do here. But in our culture, most of us sit. How many of you spend most of your job day sitting? How many of you spend most of your work day not sitting, but standing? It's many more than I expected. So, I was going to try to make the point that... that sitting is a really common activity, and breathing is common activity, and we sit, come to meditate, we just sit here and we do this very common thing. We sit and we breathe and we pay attention to it. It's very simple. However, the associations people have with sitting on the floor cross-legged is this great mystical thing that comes from, mysterious thing that comes from the mysterious, you know, Asia or whatever, and it must be really kind of spiritual and special and full of meaning. No. It's just like the really ordinary thing to do. That's why it's, we do this. We do something totally mundane. And it's the, in the ordinary, the spirituality of the ordinary, that we discover the possibility of a simple mind and heart, a simple open-handed, open-hearted relationship, open-minded relationship to life as it is, as we're living. And so I was going to talk a little bit about walking meditation. Walking is also a phenomenally ordinary activity. We walk all the time. But do we walk? How many of you really walk when you walk? You know, or just walk when you walk? I know that it's all too easy to walk and to be thinking about where you're going or planning what you're going to do next or imagining the conversation you're going to have with someone. Or next time you're kind of home, you know, walking around your apartment, taking care of things, notice, are you walking to walk, or are you walking, rushing around to kind of get the laundry out of the dryer, or, you know, to get whatever you have to do, kind of rushing around, not paying attention to the fact that you're walking. Or at work, when you're walking back and forth between different parts of your job, do you walk to walk, or is your mind consumed and preoccupied with thoughts about what you need to do? Rather than just the simplicity of walking. If your mind and your body are not in the same place, then our life is fragmented. If we're walking, say between, you know, the kitchen and the laundry room, and we're thinking about, you know, paying a bill, then our mind is off thinking about paying a bill, which has nothing about what's happening in the moment, and your body is walking through the hallway. So your body and the mind are in two different places. Most of us live our life this way. Our minds and our body are in two different places. I suspect that you had that experience in the half an hour meditation we had, that your body was here, in this room, with these people here, on this floor, in the chairs, but your mind was probably somewhere else during part of the time. Part of the time was still at work from today, or at some activity you're doing today, or thinking about tomorrow, or last week, or the weekend, or whatever. You know, it's thinking about the future, the past, or a conversation you want to have or did have. The mind and the body are not in the same place at the same time, which represents a kind of complicated scenario. It's complicated for us to be in two places. It fragments us. It separates us from ourselves. The spirituality of the ordinary, the spirituality which uses the ordinary as the gate for deep spiritual connection, is a spirituality which brings itself to be present for the ordinary activities of daily life as they're being done and as they're lived in and of themselves. So as we walk, to just be in the walking, not for any other reason, not that the head to be anywhere different place. When you're cooking, to just cook, to be with the cooking, be with the simplicity of the carrots and the onions that you're chopping and the onions you're kind of sauteing in the frying pan or whatever. Just be there with that, be in the kitchen, just there for that activity. If you go take a shower or go to the bathroom, to be there with that simplicity of that activity. And it's very, very, I find, when I let myself just be there in that activity that I'm doing, that I feel a tremendous simplicity. And in that simplicity, it's as if I'm given myself lots of space in which to live. When I find myself preoccupied with something which is not in the present moment, I'm kind of like in the dark. It's like the only place light exists is in the present. And if I'm in my thoughts about the past and the future, I've left the world of light. And I'm in this world of preoccupation, in this world of thoughts and ideas, oftentimes. And in that world, I'm in the world of my thoughts. Preoccupation means kind of lost and caught up in them. And it's almost like there's no can be feeling of there's no space there for anything to happen because we're so preoccupied, we're so tied in with the thoughts. As I find is as I choose to cook and just be with the cooking or be with washing the dishes and putting them away or whatever, there's a wonderful dance of just being present that my mind becomes simpler. And as it becomes simpler, there's a lot of space that's created. And I feel it almost as space. It's almost as if the mind suddenly has lots of room to maneuver in. And I feel all this room, this space. And in the space, the world starts feeling very different. The world that's perceived through the filter of our preoccupations, being caught up in the future or the past or our thoughts or ideas or judgments and expectations, is a very different world than what's perceived when we don't have those filters. When we don't have those filters, when we just be with the simplicity of our activities and be in the simplicity and calm, simple way of just the ordinary, tendency is we feel the world is much more hospitable, much friendlier or more tolerable than when we see it through the filter of our judgments and preoccupations, our fears and anxieties. The world becomes a hospitable place, and it becomes quite pleasant. And then, as an added bonus, I find that I actually end up thinking much more clearly when I am allowing myself to be with the activity that I'm doing. That I'm much more creative, like out of all that space that's created, all that calm or settled space, just being simple, it's as if the creative parts of the mind, the creative unconscious part of the mind, is allowed to burble up or bubble up in a way in which it can't bubble up when I'm caught up in my anxieties and concerns and fears and projections and all these things. And it's really a delight to enter into the present moment, the simplicity of the present moment, and then to be surprised by the creative powers of the mind and the heart that arise in the middle of that. So to be simple. To be simple means has a lot to do with doing one thing at a time. If we do three things at a time, the chances are that we're split from ourselves. There's very little opportunity to settle down, be quiet, to discover simplicity. Because if we're doing three things at once, then the mind is juggling many things. Many of us do at least two things at once a lot. If nothing else, driving and listening to the radio. Driving, listening to radio and talking on the cell phone. Driving, listening to the radio, talking on the cell phone and shaving. You know, it's much more efficient, you think. In Zen practice, in Zen Buddhism, they have the practice or the teaching that when you engage yourself with an activity, to really be there with that activity, to just do that one thing, you want to bring a kind of presence, a kind of observation or a kind of sensitivity to the situation, that you're actually listening to see what the situation is asking of you, as opposed to being the person in control and in charge who has an agenda and said, I know how it's supposed to be. I know who this person really is. And I'm going to go in there and relate to that person as I really know that person. I'm going to relate to this activity as I know it's supposed to be. But rather to kind of have a more open attitude. Who is this person? Let me see. What is the request from this person to me? Not rather than my demand about how it should be. What is the request of this object? In Zen, they get really specific because, you know, when you're putting away the silverware from the drying rack and to put it in your drawer, perhaps, they say, you know, what is the request of the spoon? They don't say, you know, what are you supposed to, you know, figure out what you're supposed to do with the spoon, you know, and put it in there as best you can. What is the request of the spoon? What does a spoon want? And, you know, oh, you see, oh, the spoon wants to be laid down in a certain way. You know, there's a way in which a spoon is requesting to be. that has a lot to do with the whole context of the situation. You don't just kind of throw the spoon in as quickly as you can so you can kind of get over with it. But you kind of have some sensitivity, oh, the situation and what it looks like in the drawer. Maybe you have some sense that someone else is going to come and pull the silverware out after you. And what state of mind are they going to experience if they see everything in disarray in the drawer? So what is the request of the situation? So I think it's a lovely idea. What is the request of the situation? What's the request of the object you're dealing with? What does it want from you? A famous quote in Zen goes like this. To carry the self forward, to discover what things are like, is delusion. But to let the things advance and help you discover who you are, that is enlightenment. That makes sense to you? Just to paraphrase then, if we carry with us our ideas of who we are and all the things that go with that, some self-concept, and all our projections and ideas about life and how things should be, and through the filter of that, then try to discover what the world is like, we can't really discover what it's like. We enter a kind of delusion. If it's only we're seeing it through our self-centered, egotistical eyes. But if you somehow drop the self-centered egotism and have a simplicity to see what is the request of a situation, what's happening here, what is coming towards me, what's advancing, what's moving towards me, what is the situation here, then you'll find that the things of the world will teach you who you are. And I think that's a lovely idea to me. So rather than you knowing who you are, you discover who you are by how the world comes to you and relates to you. Rather than presupposing who you are and taking who you think you are with you, carrying it with you and assuming this is the way it has to be, there's kind of an openness. In each new situation, you discover a new you. There's an infinite numbers of who you are and who you can be. In each new situation you come into, you become a new person. And you only can become a new person if you're willing to kind of have the simplicity to really be present in the present, to discover how the new situation creates you, makes you. But if you go carrying along all the same ideas into the situation over and over again, you're not allowing any openness for growth and development. If you are the know-all and know yourself and are coming along with the ego into the situation. So to appreciate a simplicity of being, partly by doing one thing at a time, and while you're doing one thing at a time, to really be there for that one activity, to recognize, to really appreciate and recognize that the value of a spirituality of the ordinary. Many people who are engaged in spiritual practices are often relating to the extraordinary. The extraordinary is what kind of their spirit, their longing is about. The extraordinary is what offers hope or promise. The extraordinary is what is going to fix it. Or the extraordinary is just has great mystery and awe as part of it. It's just, you know, it's just marvelous and it's awesome to kind of be part of. And so people are often kind of pursuing the extraordinary. In Buddhism, the extraordinary is found in the ordinary or through the ordinary. And to be allow ourselves to be an ordinary person and to allow ourselves to be engaged in ordinary activities as if those ordinary activities are our spiritual practice. So if you go off and be a monk and a nun in a monastery, then perhaps, you know, you get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and you do your chanting and you do your bowing and you do all these rituals and that seem to have tremendous meaning and is infused with spirituality and sounds really great. And then in the late mid-morning, there's a work period in the monastery and you're sweeping the temple grounds. And oh, isn't it romantic? The monastics are out there sweeping the temple grounds and the peacefulness of the great, silent monastery, and what a spiritual thing to be doing, to be sweeping the temple grounds and whatever. But the spirituality of the ordinary, for those of us who are not monastics, is to discover that getting up in the morning and making breakfast is as profound as getting up in the morning and chanting, chanting or singing hymns or whatever monastics do. That getting up in the morning and then washing the dishes after you do breakfast is as profound as doing your prostrations. Getting in your car and driving to work is as profound as sweeping the temple grounds. Taking care of, all these kind of simple, ordinary things and really being present for them are really profound. And the continuity of doing these things over time opens up a possibility of a great calm and a great peacefulness that we could maybe call the extraordinary, but it's the extraordinary which is totally about being ordinary. So in meditation, we sit with our breath as kind of the anchor, the root to the practice, so that it can help us discover how to be an ordinary person. Just to be ourselves in a deep way, not to be ourselves and continue being neurotic and continue having a busy mind that's so busy, but rather discover how to be ordinary where there's only one head instead of two. Or to do walking. Take up walking. Most of you do a lot of walking during the day. And just to do that, just to take the activity of walking during the day and say, okay, this is going to be my morning spiritual. The monks get up and do the chanting and bowing, the morning service, it's called. I don't know what it's called in Catholicism. The monks do their morning hours, or what do they do? Anyway,
devotions.
So your daily devotions is going to be your walking. So for the next week or the next few weeks, whenever you walk, to make that to be your devotions, and just to walk in a simple way. How simple can you get in walking? Can you just walk and really be aware you're walking while you walk, as opposed to thinking what you're doing ahead of yourself? I find a huge difference in what my body feels like when I walk just to walk and I'm present for it, as opposed to when I walk and I'm caught up in the complicated scenarios of my mind and getting ahead and trying to get things done as quickly as I possibly can. When I walk just to walk, I'm usually quite settled on my body. My center of gravity tends to kind of go down through my spine, and I'm kind of, balanced on my feet. When I'm involved in the complications and of my mind, and thinking ahead and rushing with my walking, I often find myself leaning forward in my walk, and my shoulders tend to go up, and I tend to get kind of tight in my chest area a little bit here. And usually I'm so caught up, if I'm caught up, I'm not aware of what the cost is to my body. But if I quiet down and pay attention to what's actually going on, I'll start noticing what that cost is. And I say, this is really how I want to live? Or do I want to live in a way that's balanced and settled on myself? So the spirituality of the ordinary, the spirituality of simplicity, if you can get some sense of what this means, and appreciate what it means, you'll go a long way to understanding the power of mindfulness practice. So those are my thoughts for today. So do you have any comments or questions about simplicity, ordinariness, or anything else? Yes?
Yeah, this is something entirely unrelated, except that when I first started meditating, I was having a lot of anxiety. And I discovered what was happening. And I was taking very large doses of a decongestant. I had surgery in the nose and sinuses. And related to that is a friend of mine has panic disorders, and that was greatly subsided when she gave up coffee.
Good, interesting.
Yeah.
So that's why I said, first I said, all our anxiety or all our stress, is caused by a mind. But then I backed off, right? I said 95% to cover myself.
Yeah.
What?
Starbucks.
Starbucks, yeah. And one of the unfortunate tendencies is that when people start getting anxious, that's often a condition for us only to get more anxious. Because as we start getting a little bit anxious, it's uncomfortable, it's unpleasant. And so, unless people know about the possibility of relaxing, they often will get anxious about being anxious, or they'll go out and get more coffee. You know, I feel really anxious, I feel like I need something to soothe me. A good hot cup of Starbucks coffee, that'll just do it. And so we take another cup of coffee, and sometimes there's going to be this cycles or spiraling, where anxiety spirals until it becomes a panic attack. And meditation is very powerful because one of the ways that meditation is powerful is that it's an example of how you can cut through the cycles by not doing anything.
My brother is a smoker. You know, smokers come to do is they smoke and calm themselves down.
And then there's the withdrawal, right?
Yeah.
So you try to stop, and then you just get anxious. So let's get another smoke. In the back.
Yeah, I was wondering, what do you suggest as kind of method to, if you sit down and you begin to breathe, but you still feel that anxiousness, how do you suggest kind of dealing with that through meditation?
Yeah, two things occurred to me to tell you. One is not to be bothered by it. And not being bothered by it means partly don't give it a lot of thoughts or concerns or worries. To allow it to be there. And then very simply just be with your breathing. Even though you might feel the anxiety, just be with the simplicity of your breath. And if you can able to rest with your breathing, stay kind of with the in-breaths and the out-breaths, that will tend to calm people down. Or you can breathe in and out through the anxiety. Like imagine the breath goes into the anxiety and breathe in and out. Another way is just to feel what the anxiety is like in the body. Kind of like just sit there. Imagine your body is like a great big huge container that can hold all the anxiety in the world. And the anxiety is going to bounce inside and bounce around and do all the stuff. But the container is going to lovingly hold the anxiety. And if you hold it with this big container of the body and don't do anything with it, then it also tends to quiet down. So that's the first thing, just to not be bothered by it, just kind of allow, just feel it and let it be. The second thing is sometimes it can be useful to pay a little bit of attention to what your thoughts are and to notice if there are particular kinds of thoughts which are causing the anxiety. And if you can be very honest about the kind of patterns of your thoughts, then maybe you can reevaluate. Or maybe you could have a more healthy relationship to your thoughts, where you don't necessarily buy into them as much as you usually do. Yes?
My therapist and you today both said that anxiety has to do with the future. So this is my lesson for today. And what comes up for me is that, well, my job is about planning and planning for contingencies in the future. And how do you get anything done? I mean, how do monks get things done without planning?
Or
is it to be focused on and say, okay, now I am planning.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
So when you plan, just plan. But you know, to do it consciously, you know, to where this I plan and say, okay, now I'm going to plan and think about things and how to do things. But I try not to plan when I don't want to. You know, I just, you know, okay, now it's time. Yes.
I'm so stuck on your cooking thing that you talked about, the creative end. Fields that I know most about are food and music, and I don't know many creative people that don't have some fairly large neurosis flying around in them. And, I mean, present company except, and I don't know everybody here, but I mean, that really seems to follow. My days of chefing were, you know, manic garlic man, you know, flying through the kitchen with great creativity, and now I don't have that creativity. It's more meditative. People are noticing the difference. You know? The risotto didn't quite taste the same as it normally does. What happened? Well, I wasn't thinking, you know, whatever it is, there seems to be a lull in the creativity these days, now that I started coming here. So.
It's a transition. Transitions are kind of rocky. It often happens, and one of the things that does happen to people sometimes is that there can be a certain drive that fuels our activity. So for example, someone can always be afraid of the future, afraid of what's going to happen, afraid they're going to lose their job. And so that fuels a kind of high energy engagement with whatever they're doing. And because of the high energy engagement, they're actually more efficient and do a better job, perhaps. So that person somehow, through meditation or therapy, whatever, learns something about how fear runs their lives. And maybe that fear is not necessary. Maybe they don't want to live fueled by fear anymore. So they start lessening their fear. And lo and behold, they find that they don't have that same drive that they used to have. And so they're not always being hyper alert. And because they're always hyper alert, they're not taking care of some of their things as well as they did before. And maybe even now they even kind of space out a little bit more because they're not so afraid. And I would take that to be a transition period. And as we settle down more and actually learn how to be in the present moment in a healthy way rather than because we're afraid, I think that you'll find that you become more and more present for that risotto, for that, you know, as you make it. And you'll be there really for it. And what is its request? What does it need? And you taste it and you're really present for it. I worked as a cook at Green's Restaurant for a year and a half, which was a very fast-paced restaurant to work in. And I loved it. I was very happy there. I was very happy to be doing things quite fast because it was required. But in doing things fast, I also learned how I can really be present for this particular activity and really see, can I really make this pizza the best pizza of the day? But I wasn't fueled by anxiety or fear or neurosis. It was just out of love for just being there for the ordinaries of this particular pizza. Nothing was more important in the whole world at that moment than making those 23 pizzas. You know, you had all these pizzas in a row, you made it, you know, I loved it. You know, just there. And I don't know, hopefully they were good. But you know, nothing was more important. So the spirituality of the ordinary is that what you're doing at the moment is the most important thing you do. If it's not the most important thing you're doing, and so if it's important because you're anxious, because of whatever, then maybe you do a good job. In a transition time, maybe what you need to do is find what is it keeping you from really being engaged in this one activity. That's part of it that might be going on. It's a common question you ask about creativity and neurosis. It's been observed many times that, especially in Western culture, that a lot of the artists and the creative types of people tend to be neurotic. And then the implication is that creativity and great works of art is a really good thing to have happen. And therefore, that justifies being neurotic. Or suicidal or whatever it is that's going on. It justifies it because it's so great to have this creative stuff. Creativity has a kind of ultimate value that maybe it has. We need to look at how much value we put in it. Maybe it's not as valuable as we think. But but the challenge a spiritual practice is that it's possible to discover a different source for creativity and motivation that's not neurotic. And in people saying, you know, I don't, you know, we need to let people be neurotic so they can be creative, or let me keep my neurosis so I can be creative, it takes a little bit different form with anger. You know, I see anger really fuels me to get a lot done. So isn't my anger good? What these people don't understand is that it's possible to tap into other wellsprings of motivation inside of us that's not fueled by either anger or neurosis or fear or anxiety. And it takes a while to discover those. And as we discover those, we discover that our creativity takes a different channel. Not a different channel, but maybe we express different things. Rather than expressing... right now, I have in front of me is an image of being in the Prado, the museum in Madrid, where there's all these paintings by Goya, and there's his late life paintings. And you see, it's like all these monstrous, demented people. It's pretty wonderful creative expression. It's really wonderful, but I don't think he was very settled on himself. if he was really settled on himself, and he might find a whole different thing that he wants to express. So what you have in Asia, at least in the ideal, is that when an artist, like a Zen artist, wants to do the painting, the artist is supposed to meditate first. Maybe spend years in meditation first, getting really settled on himself or herself, find a kind of inner peace and a sense of contentment with life, to resolve the neurosis, and then to really kind of be there with, if they're going to paint a flower, to really be there with the ordinary of that flower, and really see it for what it is in a meditative, calm way, and then wait to some huge upswelling of creative urge arises, where you can paint the daisy as if you are the daisy, or whatever, Am I making some sense? Offering an
You're saying I should go work at Greens or something. But, but I mean that in the sense that there's got to be, it's on my livelihood on the one hand. And maybe I should just step down for a while and get the package version of a risotto or something. Back to the
restaurant. Well, I don't know, what your issue, I don't know so well, a lot can be done by just paying more attention. Pay some attention to what's going on for you in the situation. And maybe it is a transition period for you.
Yeah.
And maybe you need to understand better the nature of that transition. And it's possible that people do this practice and in a paradoxical way and find themselves being more distracted for a while. Because as a person becomes more mindful of themselves, they discover aspects of themselves which are a little bit unsettling. And as they discover these unsettling parts of themselves, they get more anxious and become more distracted again. So you might spend a little bit of time trying to discern and understand a little bit better what has happened to you as you started this practice. And has the practice challenged you or frightened you in some ways? Has it made you a little bit more anxious because of what you've had to deal and look at? Has it made you less interested in things that you were so interested in before, maybe for unhealthy reasons? Maybe you're not interested in risotto anymore. You're not even interested in cooking anymore. And that's a very frightening thing to have to look at if that's what's going on. Or maybe there's a whole other way of discovering a very, very radically different way of being with the risotto that you have ever discovered before. To attain your enlightenment with the risotto. To make risotto as if it's the most important thing in the world and the person you're making it for is the Buddha. This is what I'm doing, and the Buddha will know if I'm present, so I'm going to really do it with presence and love and real love. Good luck. Last one, and then we'll sit.
I just have a suggestion for him. It's the Tassajara books by Ed Brown. It really teaches you how to cook mindfully, and they're wonderful cookbooks. I have a bunch of them. I used to make muffins all the time. And he writes, I'm sure you know this, he writes a lot about how he feels and how he's doing it. And I think it's good.
He told me the story once of... Ed Brown, by the way, was a very anxious guy. in his early years, when he was learning how to cook at the monastery in Tassajara, there were stories of him throwing knives across the kitchen at people. So the book, he came a long way before he could write those books. but he told me the story that when he sent one of his books to his editor in New York, he had a recipe or some very simple thing where it's, you know, cooking. It was like, you know, like boiling potatoes or something like that. And he said, you know, he described, you know, you put the potatoes in the boiling water and take them out when they're ready. and the editor called back and said, "How long? you take them out when they're ready. It's not how long. You kind of figure it out. You know, you have a sense. You have to put it on how long. People need to know exactly how long to keep the potatoes boiling, as if you know they need to want the recipe where you have certain rather than paying attention." So let's try to be simple for a couple of minutes here.